The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu. Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. You can go beyond giving to impact. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
From WABE in Atlanta, welcome to this edition of Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. You know, it's quite an unexpected journey of a lifetime.
But at about 10 years old, seeing a shuttle launch on TV, it was motivating and inspiring, but I didn't have a real connection. I didn't see steps, and I definitely didn't see anybody in my life that I could mimic or ask questions about how to get there.
A conversation with NASA astronaut Captain Victor Glover Jr., who will pilot Artemis II for an historic mission around the moon. And coming up in just a moment, I'll speak with Alfred Edmond Jr., the Senior Vice President and Executive Editor of Black Enterprise, about the Black Enterprise Disruptor Summit coming to Atlanta next month. Important conversations coming up, but first this. Fulton County prosecutors are asking a judge to dismiss former President Donald Trump's efforts to quash an investigation into his attempts to overturn the 2020 election. Trump has asked the courts to expunge the report of a special grand jury and disqualify the district attorney's office from prosecuting him. WABE's Sam Greenglass has more.
This spring, Trump's lawyers told a judge the investigation violates all notions of fundamental fairness. One of the false electors for Trump later joined his motion to stop the probe. Now, District Attorney Fani Willis is firing back in a new filing, arguing that Trump's request should be denied and saying in part that Trump failed to demonstrate how the investigation was tainted. A judge will decide whether to hold a hearing, which could be the first time Trump's lawyers address the court in person. Willis says she expects to announce charging decisions later this summer. Sam Greenglass, WABE News.
It was a long Atlanta City Council meeting Monday, mainly because of the 7 hours of public comment regarding construction of the controversial police and firefighter training center in South DeKalb County. Outside, there were protesters, again, calling on the Atlanta City Council to take action against the center being built. And inside, more opposition, as we hear from Shemaine Cruz.
The City Council is expected to vote on new legislation in the coming weeks, authorizing more than $33 million in city funding for the Atlanta Public Safety Training Center, also known as Cop City. Before the legislation was introduced on Monday, dozens of protesters rallied against the project outside City Hall. They say council members have frequently said there's little they can do to stop it. Kamau Franklin is with Community Movement Builders.
They decided to do what's good for them instead of doing what's good for black folks.
Protesters also took their concerns inside, with hundreds speaking during public comment. Tana Taylor says she thinks the money could be better spent on improving the quality of life for residents of the Atlanta area.
Nearly 10 in every 10,000 Georgia residents are currently experiencing homelessness. The Atlanta Police Foundation does not need this funding. The residents of Georgia and the Atlanta community does.
The 85-acre facility is expected to cost $90 million, with the rest of the funding coming from the Police Foundation. Shemaine Cruz, WABE News.
Finally, state regulators decided earlier today on the rate increase for Georgia Power customers. So, starting next month, for a typical residential customer, your power bill will go up by maybe $16 a month. Do not send me your emails. It's not my fault. It's the second of three expected increases this year. Georgia Power says it needs this one to cover the higher cost of coal and natural gas it uses to generate electricity. This is Closer Look. We're back in a moment.
Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. If you love Atlanta, you can invest in the big picture. Learn more at CF. greateratlanta.org.
I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells,
about residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there,
and the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle, stories about life on the inside told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
And Closer Look continues now from Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott. Ask any entrepreneur or startup about the biggest challenges in getting their businesses up and running. Topping the list, access to capital, or as we plain folks say, we need money. On average, Black entrepreneurs typically receive less than 2% of all venture capital dollars each year. And that number is even lower for companies led by Black women. They receive less than 1%. This is all according to the latest data from Crunchbase. And while capital plays a huge role in the success of any business, entrepreneurs need other tools and resources to expand their dreams. In an effort to help entrepreneurs level up, the longtime media company Black Enterprise is hosting the Black Enterprise Disruptor Summit. I love the name. Joining me now to talk all about this is Alfred Edmond Jr. He is the Senior Vice President and Executive Editor of Black Enterprise. Alfred, thanks for taking the time. I really appreciate it. Congratulations. You just got a big promotion, right?
Yeah, it's good to know that I'm still relevant and valuable to the company after 36 years and counting.
Now, I know all about Black Enterprise, but it might be some folks who say, hey, what's Black Enterprise? Tell me about this long time. I call it just a media conglomerate now.
We are a multimedia, multi-platform media company. We started out, we're still best known, though we don't do print media anymore, but for the iconic magazine founded by our late founder, Earl Graves Sr., so we were, the number one Black magazine for business and finance and investing and careers for the first 45 years or so of our existence. We're now in our 53rd year, but of course has spent probably the last 20 years transitioning to become a multi-platform digital media, live events, virtual events company, doing premium content as well as daily business news and other content for African Americans who want to succeed financially. Our tagline is wealth for life.
Yeah. And you all have had to shift and change how you disseminate information and engage with folks because we're in this whole digital space right now. What has that transition been like for you all over the years? Has it been kind of smooth?
No. I don't know any media company that's still standing that will say it was smooth. We just understood it was necessary. I give all kinds of credit to our current CEO, the son of the founder, Earl Graves Jr. Derek Dinglich, current chief content officer, among a generation of then younger executives who saw that the tide was turning and that you saw spending decline in print and other traditional media and increase in digital media. We started pivoting really back in the early 2000s. It was not an easy transition. You talk about culture change. It was just very challenging, but we stuck through it and made it through. And the Black Enterprise brand is so strong that most Black people can't imagine a world without it. Yeah. And that really helped us to sustain ourselves until we came out. Now on the other side is the number one digital media brand for African Americans.
Yeah, and this summit is described as 3 days to connect, collaborate, and celebrate. How did all this begin? You all saw a need to have something to bring not just, you know, entrepreneurs, small business owners, innovators, inventors, everybody.
Yeah, we've been in the events business, you know, now for close to 30 years, maybe more. Going back to the original Black Enterprise Entrepreneur Summit, we used to do a golf and tennis event, we used to do a ski event. But the goal of all of our events, whether they're in person like Disruptor Summit in Atlanta, June 2nd through 4th, or whether it's virtual, because now we do a lot of virtual events online, is really to bring people together because, as you mentioned in the lead-in to this interview, the emphasis is on the access. When we talk about a lack of access to capital, the problem really isn't lack of capital, it's lack of access. So our mission is always to bring people together, to create those relationships, to bridge those gaps so that people can get that access to need they need to the capital that exists.
You know, we're coming out, we're not out of the pandemic, but, you know, we're not at the height that it was, you know, let's say 2021. And so are you all hearing from folks saying, listen now, you know, even with inflation and everything that's going on, we have some other barriers and some other obstacles as well. So, you know, we need a little guidance as we move into how the rest of the world is navigating. And, you know, there's that saying that when America gets a cold, black folks get pneumonia. You know, because true, it trickles true. Down, it's usually worse or whatever it is.
Well, true. Here's the irony, though. First of all, because black entrepreneurs are used to operating in climates of adversity, it's only different degrees of adversity. Right. And it's one of the reasons why black entrepreneurs are among the most innovative, because black people have to be innovative. We have to learn to do less with more. We have to make our talents and our gifts go further. We have a tendency toward leaning toward excellence, because anything less than that will put us out of business. So that's a strength. Here's the other interesting thing, though, as we talk about, you're right, COVID hasn't ended. It's just the shutdown has ended. Mm-hmm. COVID forced a lot of innovation. We're seeing a lot of interesting Black-owned businesses that got started or got accelerated because of the conditions of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And what Black entrepreneurs and others in that space, whether you call them founders, entrepreneurs, creatives, the Disruptor Summit is meant to be a tent for all of them, is that we recognize that when there's challenges, there's also opportunities. And we just see a lot of, especially young entrepreneurs, taking advantage of those opportunities. And it's our job to help them succeed.
Now, I know you have guest speakers. In fact, you have two people who have been on this program before. You have Slutty Vegan founder Pinky Cole. And then you have my man Mason Wright, team founder, entrepreneur of Mason Super Dogs. I've interviewed him. He's a wonderful young man. So from that, you know, a teenager, and then to someone like Pinky Cole, and you have some other folks, there's something for everyone here. Who is this Disruptor Summit really also trying to engage?
Well, obviously, if you're already in business, the goal is to bring together resources from large corporations that want to do business with smaller entrepreneurs, as well as fellow entrepreneurs. Again, to connect the dots, to give you the relationships you need to move your company forward, to help you achieve your goals. One of our models is that everybody in the room has a piece of the puzzle, but if you don't bring everybody together, you'll never find the piece that you need. So it's really for existing entrepreneurs, but this is also really for those aspiring entrepreneurs, those people who, whether they did it by choice or because of or by circumstance, because to the term disruptor, COVID disrupted a lot of people's lives, and they began to look at new ways of living and making a living. So if you're someone who's a young business or aspiring entrepreneur, this is a great place for you to kind of jumpstart what you're doing and not have to reinvent the wheel. You can meet people who've already done it and accelerate your ability to get your business off the ground.
I probably shouldn't ask this, but I'm going to ask it. Why Atlanta? I mean, you know, Atlanta influences everything, according to our good friend, Bim.
Well, Atlanta has been established for a long time, for several generations, is a really great environment for Black entrepreneurs to come together. It's a vibrant, probably only second only to maybe Chicago, in terms of just a vibrant Black entrepreneurial landscape, especially in tech, especially in media and communications, but not limited to those areas. So even if you don't live in Atlanta, people who work outside of Atlanta still see Atlanta as a great place to go to have these conversations. Mm-hmm. We've had many Black enterprise events there over the years. And it just felt like the Disruptor Summit, this was a good place to bring it for the first time.
And I understand, Alfred, there is a pitch competition.
Yes, now you're in my heart now, because I'm
one of I got a pitch for you, and I've been pitching this for years, and it goes nowhere. I want to start a hotel for wayward cats. Like a you know.
I think in this space, here's the key. You got to figure out who's going to pay for it, but. The pet industry is so hot right now. People love.
Yeah.
You might be able to have a business model that makes that work. But yeah, the Disruptor Pitch Competition, and I've been a national pitch competition judge for many organizations over the last 30 years, is really not about just about the money. Up to $15,000 will be up for grabs for the finalists who come to pitch in Atlanta. We've been doing that for over 25 years or something similar. But what we try to do with our pitch competitions is to leverage the fact that, again, I want to go back to access. Mm-hmm. We still have to cultivate generations of African-Americans who know what to do when they get in the room with somebody with money. Mm-hmm. So it's knowing how to have that conversation. getting those relationships that you don't normally have access to, knowing how to make the case for why your company is investable, what's in it for the investor, and pitch competitions are a great way for entrepreneurs to learn that.
So let me ask you this, if you can give a gold nugget here, what do people tend to do, and I hate saying do wrong, but what do you want to advise folks against when they're in a pitch competition or they're in that room with the folks that can write that check?
I will use a quote from our late founder, Earl Graves. He says, sell to their needs, not from your needs. Too often, if you're not used to pitching your business, you pitch it from the standpoint of what you want, what's it's going to help you do, but how it's going to help your business grow. When you really need to get into the minds of what's in it for the other person, generally, if it's the investor, you want to make a case for how will this make money for you if you invest in my business.
So I need to say, look, I know y'all tired of all these stray cats coming up on your porch and in your garden. I'm going to come and take these cats and give them a home.
No, I'm helping not, you. That don't work. What an investor cares about is I found a way to give them a home that will create profit. And if you invest in this, you get a cut of that profit.
I will train the cats to be Hollywood cats, to be in movies.
That might be. Yep.
And acting.
What every investor wants to know is where does the money come out? If I put my money in,
yeah,
where does the money come out? And how much of it do I get when it comes out?
Wow. How often do you have to tell people that?
I mean, usually after well, I do a lot of mentoring. So after a couple of mentoring sessions with me, they kind of learn the language. But you got to think, suppose somebody came to you and said, listen, I want you to put $10,000 or $15,000 in my business. Mm-hmm. They would have to tell you something that would make you feel comfortable about getting that money back with a profit. Mm-hmm. And if you could really focus on what's in it for the person whose investment you are seeking, you're way ahead of the curve in terms of getting a chance to get that money invested in your business.
And we brought up the pitch competition. I've got emails already. Folks say it's still too late to register for the pitch competition.
I don't think so. So I would say go to blackenterprise.com today. Register for the Disruptor Summit. You have to be registered to the summit to enter, because we're selecting the finalists from people who are entering the event.
Wow.
I am one of the judges, so I'm kind of giving you some free game in terms of what I'm going to be looking for. But yes, it's not. You go to blackenterprise.com and Disruptor Summit. You'll see it in the drop down, and you'll learn more about the deadlines.
And often, and Alfred, I know it's not lost on you when we hear that so many businesses fail within that, between the 3 and 5 years. It used to be 3 and 5 years. I don't know if it's the same, but and we don't like to talk about why businesses fail, but it is important for folks to understand that it's not always just because of lack of revenue. It could be folks just not understanding how to properly run and operate a business.
Well, I tell entrepreneurs, first of all, don't be so hard on yourself. Most successful entrepreneurs, the ones that we celebrate, if you look into their history, they started businesses, they sold businesses, they started businesses, the businesses failed. You know, if you're an entrepreneur, you outlive your businesses. Mm-hmm. So sometimes I think we give Black entrepreneurs a hard time because it is 3 to 5 year, but that's typical because not every business is meant to last beyond that point. What's more important is that you learn from each experience, because the most successful entrepreneurs learn from their previous businesses and they build that experience into the big business that they're celebrated for and successful for. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's true. Sometimes it's not the entrepreneur's fault at all. Some businesses just, the life cycle ends of that business ends, and you just need to accept that the way you might accept that, you know, a flower that you planted didn't last forever because they weren't meant to.
And we've had conversations on this program during the pandemic where we saw a lot of Black-owned businesses by Black women being, you know, started, and in the Latino community as well. Are we still seeing those numbers at the top in terms of who's coming online in terms of small business ownership?
The fastest growing entrepreneurial groups remain Black and brown women. That has not changed. And I don't think it's likely to change in the near future. Mm-hmm. One, because when you talk about the lifestyle flexibility that people look for in entrepreneurship, women lean toward that because they often have to play multiple roles in their families and their communities. The other thing is, though, women are still facing a lot of barriers in corporate America. So they're far more likely to realize, you know, I'm not going to go much further in this. So I'd rather invest in my own dreams and what I'm doing. So it's kind of a double-edged thing. Some of it is because, again, they want to do it, for the flexibility. Some of it is a perception of opportunities in corporate America and other places, and they eventually decide to do, you know, do their own thing. But yeah, the irony though, and you spoke to it earlier, they're the fastest growing entrepreneurial class, but they're also getting the least amount of capital, which is unfair. So that's one of the things we challenge all the time at Black Enterprise.
And you all will talk about that during this Disruptor Summit.
Absolutely.
Alfred Edmond Jr., the Senior Vice President and Executive Editor of Black Enterprise. Black Enterprise's Disruptor Summit takes place here in Atlanta, June 2nd through the 4th at the Grand Hyatt Hotel. For more information, we'll have a link on our website, or you can visit their website as well. Alfred, thank you so much for taking time. I appreciate it. I'm going to work on that pitch for my home for wayward cats, and somebody's going to invest in that soon.
Keep me posted.
I got you. I appreciate you.
My pleasure.
Well, there's a reason we're playing this song. Closer Look continues from WABE in Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott. Perhaps this next statement is appropriate. In order to better the future, we can always look to the past.
At the foot of the ladder, the lamb footbeds are only depressed in the surface about 1 or 2 inches, although the surface appears to be very, very fine-grained as you get close to it. It's almost like a powder. Ground mass is very fine.
And, of course, that is the voice there of Neil Armstrong. Let's go back. July 20th, 1969, Apollo 11, the first manned mission to land on the moon.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
And how many times have we heard that? But even before that eventful moment, there was Project Mercury, which was the first U.S. program to put humans in space. In fact, there would be 25 flights, six of which carried astronauts between 1961 and 1963. From then till now, 6 decades in the making, and the United States space program is preparing yet for another mission. And so it was announced this past April 3rd.
I'm Christina Cook. I'm a mission specialist.
I'm Jeremy Hansen. I'm a mission specialist.
I'm Victor Glover. I'm the pilot.
I'm Reed Wiseman. I'm the commander for the Artemis II mission to the moon.
To the moon.
To the moon.
To the moon.
I can't believe there's not a journalist. Artemis II, NASA's first crewed flight test of the Space Launch System rocket, an Orion spacecraft around the moon. As to why, well, my next guest can explain it far better than I can. Captain Victor Glover Jr., the pilot for Artemis II. The mission, well, he's always been pretty busy here lately these days, but he's taking time for a closer look and joining us from NASA. Captain Glover, thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Yes, thank you for having me, Rose. Happy to be here this morning.
I asked you before we came on air, what time do you get up?
Between 5 and 5:30. I'm a morning person, but also I've got kids in high school, and it starts early these days.
Now, are you checking homework, too, to make sure?
One of my favorite things. I tried to do it when I was on the International Space Station, and it was a little harder, a little more logistically challenging. But that's one of my favorite things to do, is to help my kids with their schoolwork.
Wow. Well, where do we begin? And I believe it was your fellow crew member, Jeremy Hansen, that referred to this mission as, quote, an ambitious goal for humanity, close quote. I'll let you take that further for our listeners and how important this mission is.
Yes, this is the first time humans are going to ride the Space Launch System rocket, supported by our exploration ground systems that gets us out to and from the launch pad, and to ride inside of the Orion spacecraft. So it's a test mission, but really this is the beginning of humanity's journey back out further into space, into deep space beyond low Earth orbit, where our International Space Station currently orbits with seven humans on board. And so it's been since December of 1972 that humanity has been confined to low Earth orbit. We stopped going to the moon then. And this is the beginning of a journey not just to get back to the moon sustainably and responsibly, but also this is enabling us to create the technology, but also to build the teams that are going to be necessary for going on to Mars.
And for someone listening saying, okay, listen, we know this is a 10-day flight, Artemis II flight test, but in as simple as you can put it, someone saying, what in the world, or rather, what in the outer world, will y'all be doing?
So we're going to test the spacecraft. We're going to make sure that humans can survive in this spacecraft for 10 days. And once we know that, then we can do more challenging and bigger things. We can dock to a lander spacecraft and go to the surface of the moon. That'll enable us to go to a space station type of vehicle that is orbiting the moon and stays around the moon. So this one mission is really what I call part of a relay race. This is a relay race, and we have the baton, but we will be passing the baton on to more and more complex missions that will advance science and technology.
And Captain, this mission, like many others, requires a lot of folks. You know, you have an astronaut corps. That includes dozens of scientists, engineers, technicians, and I'm just naming a few here. What's the total number of personnel designated, devoted to Artemis II?
Wow, you know, that's a great question. And Rose, I'm actually going to go find out because I don't know exactly, but I can tell you there are thousands of people involved all around the world. I mean, just in this country, I could list some company or school or a NASA center in every state, every one of our 50 states that has a part in this SLS, Space Launch System rocket, the ground systems or the Orion spacecraft. But then to control it, we have control centers all over the world. Mm-hmm. Part of our spacecraft, the service module, is built by a European aerospace company. And, you know, we have a Canadian on board, the first non-American that will leave low Earth orbit and get into the vicinity of the moon. So we have thousands of people all over the world, and I'm going to find out what that number is and get back to you.
I want it on record that I asked Captain Glover, a man who has IKE, which stands for I Know Everything, and I asked you something and you didn't know the answer.
Well, you know how nicknames work. You know, they call the bald-headed guy Curly. You know, they call it. So you know how that works, right?
Let's go back even a little bit further, because you've been on missions to the International Space Station, I believe, in 2020 and back in 2021. How different, Captain Glover, is the technical and then the physical preparation for this type of mission? Which, by the way, folks, is not like he's leaving tomorrow. They're all going next year, in November, right? 2024 or somewhere around there?
Correct. It's currently planned for November of next year. And we will go, though, when the vehicle and the software and the teams are ready. And so the physical and technical preparation for this mission, it will be different. It's not getting ready for a six-month-long mission. You know, you go to the space station, and it's home and work. That's more like leaving to go to college. You have to prepare to move out and go live somewhere else. Even though you may still get mail at home at your parents' house, you're moving across the state, across town, across the country, and you're planning to be there a while. This mission is more like going on a camping trip. Home is still home, and you're going in this very high-tech tent. And if you look at the Orion spacecraft, it's almost shaped like a tent or a water droplet. But that vehicle is going to be home for 10 days. But because of that, we will take less things with us. We have less exercise devices, and so some of the training will be similar, learning spacecraft propulsion, data cooling, communication systems. But the biggest difference is just the amount of logistics going with us, because we're only going for 10 days. We've got all our food, our clothing, and it's going to be a very busy mission, sort of like our space shuttle missions were, that were on the order of 2 weeks. This mission is going to be a very dense 10 days of testing out the spacecraft and then eventually landing in the Pacific Ocean under the parachutes, making sure that heat shield worked.
Let's talk about this vehicle for a moment. And because as right now, so it's still being, I won't say configured, but it's still being put together in a sense.
Correct. It's currently out at Kennedy Space Center in something we call the Industrial Operations Zone. It's in the building we actually stay in. When you see the astronauts walk out of that building mm-hmm. to go get in the car or drive out to the launch pad, that's the Neil Armstrong Operations and Checkout Facility. And it's in that building in the IOZ, the Industrial Operations Zone. And it's I went and saw the vehicle in late March or early April. It looks like a spacecraft. You can tell it's a spaceship. It still has some pieces to be added to it, a few avionics boxes. The heat shield is going to be integrated soon, but mm-hmm. It's starting to look like a spaceship, and it's ready to go. It had parts from Artemis 1, the mm-hmm. first Orion we launched at the end of last year that we had to take off of the Artemis 1 capsule to put mm-hmm. on this one. But essentially, all the piece parts are there and ready to be integrated and then stacked on top of the rocket.
Have you had conversations with, we'll call them for the sake of this conversation, the OGs
yes.
of NASA and the astronauts? And what do they tell you?
Hey, you know, no, this is so important. Look, the OGs are still around. And, you know, one of the most encouraging parts of this is to hear their excitement. Mm-hmm. Harrison Schmitt, Jack Schmitt, the only geologist that we sent to the moon in the Apollo program, he is very excited. He has strong opinions about what we should do and what kind of science this is going to open the door, what big questions we need to answer, and where we should go land on the moon. And so it's inspiring to see them excited. And I have a mentor who I took his astronaut pin to the International Space Station, yeah. Apollo 9 astronaut Rusty Swikert.
Wow.
And I think there are plans for us to get together with them formally and sit down and just, you know, eat the crumbs off the table, if you will, just to learn from them and spend time with them. So, yes, and I will say they are very engaged in what NASA's doing. We have something called the ASAP. It's a panel that oversees what we're doing. And one of the members of that is a man named Tom Stafford, General mm-hmm. Tom Stafford. An OG, but he is still very active in his 90s, and he is still wow. going. He's still technically sharp, and to listen to him speak is just amazing. So, yes, we have the blessing and the support of the OGs.
And let's talk about your role here, because I think when I hear, well, the pilot is Captain Victor Glover. You don't say, welcome aboard, everybody. Now, do you?
I might. You know, it's also important to have a little bit of fun. So,
yeah.
You know, put your seat backs and your tray tables in the full upright position as we get ready for takeoff. And out your left window, you'll see the Atlantic Ocean. And off your right side, you'll see the beautiful glades of Florida. So it's interesting. So, we, you know, the roles in the vehicle are the commander, the pilot. Then we have a mission specialist, mm-hmm. one and two. And so, one, that determines which seat I'll sit in. I'll be on the commander's right side. Mm-hmm. And I will be in front of displays. I'll have hand controllers. But both of us will be able to fly the vehicle. And actually, one really important thing, we want to train up everybody. All of the mm-hmm. people in this spaceship are there to evaluate the vehicle, how it is to live and exercise and eat and sleep. We also want to know what they think about how we fly this vehicle. Mm-hmm. Because on future missions, while the commander and I are both test pilots, the future missions may have physicians, scientists, and engineers sitting at the controls. And so we want them to also fly this spaceship. But my primary responsibility, maybe that's the difference. My primary responsibility is to make sure the vehicle and its subsystems are configured to execute the mission.
I want to shift for a moment because I believe it was a fellow crew member that talked about the diversity of the entire Artemis II core. And it's taken quite a bit of time, but it's not like it used to be. We know that NASA has come a long way, but still has a long way to go in terms of that area. How would you assess what NASA's been able to do in terms of its diversity and making sure that, you know, this is obviously an industry, a field that not just can attract a diverse pool of candidates, but also keep them engaged and get young folks engaged early.
So vital. Well, let me put this in context. First and foremost, our country is experiencing something called the gray wave, the retirement of the baby boomer generation, and our science and technology workforce is going away faster than we're replacing it. The numbers of students studying science, technology, engineering, mathematics is decreasing, and so we need to inject support for STEM and science and technology, and encourage kids to go out and do these very challenging things. They are very challenging career fields to get into, mm-hmm. but they're very rewarding. And so we need to encourage and inspire young people to make those kinds of decisions, those life decisions. And so it's important for this mission to represent all of America and really all of humanity. When we leave the planet, we represent humanity. I may wear an American flag on my left shoulder, but when we leave our country and our planet, we're representing humanity. And it's important for people to be able to connect to this mission. And so it is important that we are exploring for all people, but also by all people.
Now I want to go back a little further to way back to little Victor Glover growing up in California. Who was this kid? Tell me about him.
Oh, man. This kid loved sports and food and had a mom and dad who loved him and a stepmom. I was born out of wedlock and you know, raised by two parents that I didn't always have them both at the same time. But, you know, we made it work. And so it's a little bit of a complicated childhood. But I tell you what. I didn't know it was complicated at the time. I just knew I had parents and grandparents who loved and supported me. And they are directly responsible for me being able to chase and catch some of my own dreams. And, you know, another thing I think is really important in this story is back then I used to love to take my toys apart and see what I could turn them into. And I'd try to turn a train into a plane and a race car into a robot. And so I would take things apart, and my parents and my grandparents tolerated it because you know, it wasn't always a good thing to see me taking apart toys, but they were happy when I put them back together and didn't have a whole bunch of pieces left over.
When did you know space exploration, going to the moon? I don't know if you thought about going to the moon when you were 10, but when did that hit you?
Well, I say it came in waves. I didn't have this, like, you know, in my bones, I want to be an astronaut. I didn't know that field. I didn't really understand the steps to get there. I just saw people on TV launching and leaving the planet. And I thought, I want to drive that vehicle. I wanted to be a stuntman and a policeman like my father. And so I thought of, okay, that looks like a really amazing adventure. I used to sit in the backyard and stare up at the moon. And to this day, I still see a rabbit in the rocking chair on the moon with the ears flying back. You know, I never really thought about going to it, but I was always fascinated by it, hearing that the tide and the ocean was responding to the gravity of the moon and seeing it full. And then, you know, a new moon and all in eclipses. I just was amazed by all of that. And the fact that it always looked the same. And as I got older, it still looked the same. That was amazing. But at about 10 years old, seeing a shuttle launch on TV, it was motivating and inspiring, but I didn't have a real connection. I didn't see steps, and I definitely didn't see anybody in my life that I could mimic or ask questions about how to get there. So it's interesting. You used a word. When did I know? Mm-hmm. You know what, Rose? To be honest, I didn't know until I was 37 and they called me and said, do you want to come to Houston to start astronaut candidate training? And there's a lot. There's a lot to unpack there, but I don't know if we have time. But so I didn't have that certainty. I had a lot of self-doubt.
Because you were a naval aviator, right? A test pilot?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. And so being in test pilot school, I was in test pilot school and saw our current deputy administrator, Pam Melroy. She told the story. She was one of the first female shuttle commanders. And talking about her mission, that was definitely the moment I decided I am going to apply. I'm going to put in an application and see if I can join that team. But I didn't really expect to get much consideration. And that when I did in that round, I didn't have a master's degree. I wasn't complete with test pilot school, so I didn't go very far. Yeah. And then I applied the next time around and got the phone call.
I want to play something for you, and I'll let you navigate our conversation afterwards.
A rat done bit my sister Nell with Whitey on the moon. Her face and arms began to swell and Whitey's on the moon. I can't pay no doctor bills, but Whitey's on the moon. 10 years from now, I'll be paying still while Whitey's on the moon. You know, the man just upped my rent last night cause Whitey's on the moon. No hot water, no toilets, no lights, but Whitey's on the moon.
Now, it's about 2 minutes long, and we'll definitely have the full version on our website, but I'll let you take it from here and why that is so important to you. That is the late Gil Scott-Heron's Whitey on the Moon.
Yes, yes. So why is it so important to me? It's important to me because it represents a facet of this mission in our country that is misunderstood or even not understood at all, not even identified. And so when I showed up at NASA, knowing the importance of outreach, I made a point to not just go out into the public and try to educate the public on what NASA does. I made a point to try and educate NASA on where I'm from and what people of color deal with in the communities that we don't always reach. And my community, where I come from, I'm from Pomona, California. And so the song represents a facet of America that wasn't just cheering for Apollo in the 1960s. Mm-hmm. 1968 was a really a terrible year. Martin Luther King was assassinated. There were issues, the Vietnam War, protests in this country, protests all over the world. Mm-hmm. And it's a really interesting time. And when the moon astronauts came back in 1968, one of the letters they received was from someone that says, "Thank you, you saved 1968." So what I wanted to do is to encourage astronauts and our engineers and flight directors and our team to think about the broader community and to think about what it means that people are still dealing with, you know, high prices and healthcare and potholes. And so to just be sensitive to the fact that we don't all have the same experience, and so that we can be sensitive to that and think about how what we're doing moves the needle for everybody. It's really instructive that in 1969, the Apollo 11 launch, one mm-hmm. of the most amazing moments in human history, mm-hmm. was protested by Ralph Abernathy and a group of folks that came out to Kennedy Space Center. Mm-hmm. And the NASA administrator said, if we could not push the button tomorrow and solve hunger, And these problems that you're here to protest about, we would do that. But in fact, he said, I love these words. I want you to hitch your wagon to what we're doing at NASA and tell people that NASA is an example of what this country can do. Mm-hmm. So when my colleagues say words like that, this is an example of what we do when we work together. We can do big things. I want them to be saying that with their heart and their arms around everybody.
So when someone says to you, and I don't know if you've, I'm assuming I probably shouldn't, if you've had these conversations, folks says, they say, well, why do we need to further explore going to the moon and then eventually Mars? And how does that, as, and this is quote coming from NASA, quote, paving the way for future for long-term human exploration missions to the moon and eventually Mars? Someone says, yeah. Why?
Yes, yes, because going to space requires us to have the things in this country that support better, more efficient, more effective, and eventually more affordable healthcare. It requires us to take our environment more serious, to think about power creation and generation and storage, using batteries more efficiently. The fact that we all walk around with little teeny devices in our pocket that can mm-hmm. translate language, tell us directions to get to the store, and find cheap gasoline is all powered by technology that helped us get to the moon. And the fact that we can communicate so easily, those are just examples of the kinds of technologies that are benefiting us here on the ground mm-hmm. on Earth. This program has supported thousands. You talked about how many people are on the team to help yeah. make Artemis II work. Mm-hmm. Those people have very high quality science and technology jobs and have. We've been working on this for about 20 years. And so this is what it's about. It isn't just those lofty goals out in space. It's about what we do back here in our communities at home that is moving the needle for everybody.
And when you speak to kids, big and little, what's that one usual question you get?
Oh, okay. Well, I get a lot of them, but what it's like to go to the bathroom, what looking at the planet was like the first time, that first view of Earth. And I like both of those. They both connect to the human experience, right? I'm a yeah. person.
Yeah.
And I've lived at sea level for most of my life. And so to be 400 kilometers or 250 miles above the surface of the Earth and look out without any device, no telescope, no microscope, And with these regular old human eyes, to see the beauty of this planet is just breathtaking.
Well, brace yourself, because I'm joined now by 12-year-old Sean and 8-year-old Arjun, and they have some questions. We're going to turn our camera around here for a second. All right. So can you see them?
Come up. Hey, how you doing?
All right, bring that microphone over there. This is a brand new microphone, Arjun. Don't break it now, okay?
Hi, Sean. Hi, Arjun.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us.
Okay, now who wants to go first? Arjun, you want to go first?
Yeah, I'll go first.
What's your question?
My question is, how long does it take to get to the moon and back?
Oh, great question. I'm glad you put to get back. That's important. So for this mission, for Artemis 2, we're going to launch and we're going to do 2 laps around the Earth within the first day. And then when we actually burn the engines to go to the moon, that's the same energy that's going to get us back to Earth. But the way to the moon is going to take about 4 days. 4 days, the gravity of Earth will kind of slow us down. And then the gravity of the moon, as we get closer, will speed us up and pull us toward the moon. And so 4 days we'll get there, and it'll take about 4 days to get back. Just to compare, though, so this mission will be about 9 days and some hours, 10 days total. Just to compare, though, there are missions that have gotten the distance to the moon faster. We launched the New Horizons spaceship, which was going all the way to Pluto to take pictures, and it got to the moon. That same moon we're talking about, it's going to take us 4 days. It got there in 8 hours. So it was going a whole lot faster. So it depends on the mission and what's on it and how heavy it is. But for our mission, it'll be 4 days there and 4 days back.
All right. You got another one?
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
Can you eat in space?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I don't think I would go if they didn't let us eat in space. Yeah, we take our food with us, and so we have special food that can last a long time, similar to the military meals ready to eat, or camping food, if you've ever had camping food. But unfortunately, we don't take Tang, and we don't have freeze-dried ice cream up there. Oh. But I wish we did.
All right. And Sean, what's your question?
So my question is, you know how when something's going really fast, it sets on fire? Would, like, the parachute burn up too? Like, how does it engage even though the capsule is heating up?
Oh, great question. The capsule is going so fast that when we come back from the moon, it'll be going about 7 miles per second. And that's so fast that the air around it turns into a plasma. It's like riding inside of a fireball. You're right. The air just vaporizes. It's so hot. And that's due to friction. So to get rid of that energy and protect the spaceship and the crew, we have a heat shield that burns off. It dissipates. It gets rid of that energy by burning the heat shield off. And so the first thing that slows us down is actually not the parachutes. It's the atmosphere. The air that we breathe that's around the Earth, that atmosphere is also the first thing that slows us down. And then once the atmosphere slows us down, we have a series of parachutes that come out. And the smaller ones come out first, and then they pull out the bigger parachutes, and then the parachutes open slowly to not have too much air go in them so that the parachutes are safe. That great question. We definitely have to protect those parachutes.
You got another question?
How does it feel when the other stages of the rocket drop?
Oh, good question. So I've only done that once, and the Falcon rocket that I rode on top of, when that staging happened, it was like you were accelerating and being pushed back into your seat. And then it felt like someone tapped the brakes, and I leaned forward toward the displays. And then when the engine lit up again, it pushed me back into my seat. So I definitely felt that. It was like speeding up, slowing down, and then speeding up again as I was pushed back in the seat. And we continued to accelerate for 6 more minutes to get to space. It was pretty amazing.
How much fun do you have speaking with kids?
I love it. This is one of my favorite parts of the job. No kidding. I love to fly, but I love to fly because I love talking about it with kids and the excitement that is connected to aerospace. And so in another part too, though, I am also responsible for finding my replacement. So the next generation of astronauts is out there, and the sooner we can identify them and encourage them, Sean and Arjun, to work hard and to do your best and to be good to each other and to your classmates and to become good, responsible citizens. That's a big part of what I do, and I take that very seriously.
Captain Glover, as we wrap up, you just a moment ago talked about what it's like to be 250 miles looking down on planet Earth. Can you put into words what your journey has been like thus far? And if you had anything to tell, and I know it's a cliche question, but I'm a journalist, I'm going to ask it anyway. If you had something to tell 10-year-old Victor Glover, what would it be?
This journey has been, I have to use this word, enchanted. It's been blessed. It's been better than what I would have thought if I had to write it out. If I had a genie in a bottle and I could have wished for it, I wouldn't have wished for it to be this good. I have a wife who loves and tolerates me and four kids who are amazing and chasing their own dreams. And I work very hard for them. And I'm glad folks encouraged me to study something challenging and to go into a job that I could pour my all into. And for all the challenges, it's just like going to the gym. You can't run fast if you don't try to run fast sometimes. You have to work hard to become good at something. And those challenges turned into education and training and skills, things I could do with my hands and my brain. And on the way, I've made some great friends and had some really amazing adventures. But most important, I've been a part of some really amazing teams, starting with my family and now NASA and our Navy. And so when I think back to 10-year-old me who didn't know any college graduates, didn't know engineers and scientists, and never really understood what it meant to be an astronaut, just I wanted to drive a space shuttle. What I would tell myself has changed. I used to just say I would tell myself that it will be okay because I had a lot of worry, a lot of self-doubt. I didn't see myself going to college, definitely to study engineering. But here's what I need to add to that. Because it worked out because I listened to those people, the OGs. I listened to the mentors. And so it's going to be okay because you're going to do the work. That's what I would say to the 10-year-old me. It's going to be okay because you're going to work hard.
Captain Victor Glover Jr., a member of the NASA and the Canadian Space Agency's astronauts who will venture around the moon, or moonish, as they say, on Artemis II. Artemis II is currently set to launch in late 2024. Captain Glover, can I call you Victor now?
Oh, please call me Victor, yes.
Now, I was trying to be, you know, keep the proper protocol, but Vic, can I call you Vic?
Yes, of course.
Thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it. Thank you for also speaking with these young folks here. That's always, always so important.
Rose, thank you. Thank you for having me. Thank you for sharing the news of Artemis and our adventure. And Sean and Arjun, thank you for getting up early to join us. It was great to hear your questions.
All right. Take care now.
Take care.
To the moon and back. That's it for this edition of Closer Look. Our producers are LaShawn Hudson and Daniel Razel. Our supervising producer is Tiffany Griffith. Our engineer is Sonia Vanderwerth. A reminder, let me know your thoughts on today's program or any other. Send me an email, rose@wabe.org. Stay tuned to WABE from Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The Gold Dome Scramble podcast is now Plugged In, a WABE politics podcast. New name, same in-depth, on-the-ground reporting from us, WABE politics reporters Sam Greenglass and Raul Bally. We'll cover local, state, and national politics as we go beyond the headlines with journalists, voters, and politicians. New episodes drop Fridays starting April 26th. Listen and subscribe at WABE.org or your favorite podcast platform.